Well, that's the Iranian national anthem introduced this year to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And today we want to discuss the ongoing, perhaps on the verge of concluding a negotiation between the United States and the Islamic Republic of Iran concerning a new nuclear deal to try to supposedly halt Iran's drive to a nuclear weapon, replacing the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action that was agreed to by Joe Biden's predecessor, Barack Obama, in 2015, which President Donald Trump withdrew from in 2018. And to discuss these important issues, we want to talk with the Republican Jewish Coalition Congressional Affairs Director, Noah Silverman. I guess full disclosure, I should say that Noah is a college classmate of mine from Amherst College, so I guess you should know we have a preceding personal connection there. Well, Noah, thank you for joining the show.
Thanks, Andy. Glad to be with you.
Well, just starting out here, how close is now the Islamic Republic of Iran to obtaining nuclear weapons?
Well, it's a matter of some guesswork because we don't have that great visibility. But what we think is that the enrichment that they've been doing puts them less than 6 months away from having enough material for a nuclear bomb.
Okay, so that would be then the highly enriched uranium, the HEU, as it's called, to the fissile material to make a nuclear weapon. And then there would perhaps be additional time they would have to develop, you know, an actual warhead and missiles and so forth, which they've also been working on.
Right, and the it shows how the things have evolved in a bad direction since the 2015 deal. At that point, the expectation was that Iran could be held 1 year from developing a nuclear weapon. Now, even on the Biden administration's own account, it would be 6 months or less. So one of the issues, of course, is whether the Biden administration is going to try to portray this as a revival of the original deal or admit that it's a different deal, because that makes a difference in terms of whether Congress gets a chance to vote on it. If it's a new deal, Congress certainly has a prerogative to vote on it under the 2015 Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act. And I think any fair reading would conclude that it is a new agreement, but we're not sure that fair reading is what we're going to get from the Biden administration.
I see. So the six-month timeline would also include not just the fissile material, the highly enriched uranium, or for that matter, any plutonium, but also the actual development of a warhead and they've already developed missile capability. So I guess we're talking about then developing the warhead to put on a missile such that you could actually implement this as a weapon, or for that matter, putting on a plane. So 6 months in total is estimated that under this deal, under the restrictions of this deal, it would take about 6 months for Iran to develop a functional nuclear weapon.
Right. And, of course, the missile side, it depends on how ambitious of a target the Iranians have their eyes set on. The missile technology is widely believed to be sufficient to deliver a warhead to Israel or to another Middle Eastern country or to parts of Europe. We think their ultimate ambition, though, is to have technology robust enough that they'd be able to target our country. And unfortunately, the missile restrictions that common sense would dictate should be part of this have been held out, but first by the Obama administration and now by the Biden administration, have been held out as not part of the deal, and that's part of what makes it so dangerous.
Yeah, so Biden then is continuing on. That was a criticism of the original JCPOA, this Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, that it just didn't even touch any ballistic missile development. I believe that was under there are separate sanctions on that under the United Nations. But now again, we're talking about that Biden's not going to do anything about this, so the Iranians can just freely develop whatever missiles they want, and they already, as you say, have missiles that can reach as far as even some parts of Europe. So it's a considerable threat.
Right, and in fact, the original deal ended up weakening the UN missile restriction. So, in that sense, it was a step in the wrong direction.
Well, now you say that any fair reading of the deal is that it really would be a new deal, and that would involve more review from Congress. Explain that a bit. What's the role of Congress here? I mean, historically we think of treaties, they take a two-thirds majority in the Senate to pass, but this is not being treated as a treaty here.
Right. There's another category, so-called executive agreements, and these are foreign policy agreements between our country and another country that are treated as different from a treaty, but still have all the force and apply. And that was something where Congress in 2015, the Republicans really made a strong case that the original JCPOA should be submitted as a treaty, but they didn't have an effective mechanism or a point of leverage to compel the Obama administration to submit it as such. And so what Congress ended up doing, and this was a Republican-led Congress in both the House and the Senate at the time, they passed a statute called the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act, and that statute provided for congressional review of any nuclear agreement with Iran. And what it unfortunately ended up turning the two-thirds requirement for a treaty on its head, instead of requiring that proponents of a treaty muster two-thirds support in the Senate. If the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act provided that Congress would have to pass a resolution of disapproval, that would pass theoretically, and in fact it did pass the House with a majority vote, but then in the Senate it would be subject to filibuster, and that's what ended up happening to the resolution of disapproval in 2015. There were bipartisan majorities in both chambers to oppose the Obama deal, but the Democrats in the Senate filibustered the motion of disapproval. Even if there hadn't been a filibuster and the Senate had followed the House's course and passed the resolution of disapproval, it would have been subject to presidential veto, and that, of course, can only be overturned by a two-thirds vote. So, as I say, it is a perfect reversal of the onus that would exist with a treaty. In under the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act, the onus is on opponents to muster a two-thirds Senate and House support level to prevent the Iran nuclear agreement from going forward, and that's how we ended up with the JCPOA.
Okay, so that this is this INARA, Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act, is by the terms it's only applicable to the same agreement that was agreed to by Obama in 2015, and not any new agreement. So if it's a new agreement, if this under Biden is classified as a new agreement, what can Congress then do?
Well, they need to make a case, and I think they will have a strong case to make that this is a new agreement because it touches on things that the original deal didn't by providing a lot of sanctions relief for the Iranians. It shortens the breakout time, and members of Congress in both parties have spoken out and said that they think this is an agreement that is subject to the 2015 law. The 2015 law says any agreement with Iran, and as such, it would seem to apply. I think it's tough to know what the administration's thinking is on this because they're playing their cards very close to the vest. But it seems like congressional Democrats are uneasy with the idea of bypassing Congress and bypassing the specific statute. So I guess we're cautiously optimistic that there will be an opportunity for a congressional vote, even if it's not realistic to pass a resolution of disapproval. We would have an opportunity for accountability, and that's what I think is what we have to be thinking about at this point, of getting elected representatives on the record to whether they're really prepared to go along with this or not.
So if it's a new agreement, then that means this older ANERA Act, this Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act, is just simply not applicable, and so there's no specified review whatsoever, and so it's just an executive agreement, and Biden's not bound by anything. So even the only limited review possibility would be if you say that it falls under the older ANERA Act, that this is an agreement with Iran.
Right.
Well, looking at this Iran nuclear agreement, what are the things this agreement will include in this entire package here? What's sort of the general shape of what will be the conditions of the agreement? Noah?
I muted myself by accident there. Sorry about that. Glad to be back with you. The agreement, as in the 2015 agreement, the Iranians agreed to limit their uranium enrichment to a certain level. They agreed to ship out the enriched uranium they have to Russia, which is something that looks a lot worse in the current scenario than it did in 2015, although it was suspect then as well. The agreement is supposed to cap and limit the Iranians' ability to deploy the uranium they've already enriched. The problem with that has always been that we don't know the extent of their nuclear activities, and so we don't know whether we've actually cabined their program the way that the Obama administration claimed that they had when they were selling the 2015 deal. That transparency, and particularly accountability for exploring and getting clarity on the previous nuclear activities has been a concern all along. The Israelis, after the deal had gone into effect, pulled off this daring raid where they were able to extract the nuclear archive that the Iranian regime had maintained, and that gave some clarity and made it clear that the Iranians had not been upfront about what they were doing with the military dimensions of their previous nuclear activities. And so it's another illustration of the Obama administration's approach of trusting the Iranians being totally deficient and leaving us really vulnerable because we don't have, we've never had a complete picture of what the Iranians have been up to in this area.
Mm-hmm. And so in this new deal, are we going to have any proper, safeguards or inspections regime? I mean, under the old deal, there were criticisms like the Iranians could just declare any nuclear site a military installation, and then there would be no inspections there.
Right, and we think that will continue to be the case with the new deal, and I guess there's a good opportunity to mention that the Biden administration promised all along was that there would be a longer, stronger deal. That is, a deal that addressed the deficiencies in the 2015 deal by limiting the, or ideally removing the sunset clauses that gave Iran a pathway to a nuclear weapon if they just waited a few years, and stronger in the sense that it would provide the accountability that the original deal was lacking. But the Iranians at the negotiating table, backed by the Russians and the Chinese, have resisted anything that would make the deal stronger or anything that would make the deal longer. And so we don't have any expectation that we'll have any better of a visibility into the full dimensions of their program if this new deal goes through than we did with the old deal.
Yeah, I mean, I believe if I'm correct in saying that this renegotiation, it's actually just going to result in using the same old timeline from the 2015 JCPOA, and so therefore that those provisions of that JCPOA start to sunset in 2025, and then ultimately the entire deal in 2030, if I'm correct in saying that. So we're just jumping back into this deal, which is ultimately going to be ended by 2030.
And that's such a key point. I mean, we knew that the Obama administration had a hope of changing the nature of the Iranian regime. They thought that if the deal was enacted, the Iranians could be engaged commercially, and that they could be brought into made better citizens of the world. And of course, none of that ever happened. But the notion that they could be reformed within 15 years was, I guess, thinkable. But now that we're only 7 or 8 years away from the expiration of the deal, the notion that the regime would fundamentally change in that interval just looks completely ludicrous. It's implausible, and I think that's a big part of why the Democrats in Congress, some of them, are uneasy with this deal, because the degree of credulity you have to have to buy it is that much greater than it was in 2015. And, of course, it should be said, in looking at the congressional dynamic, there's a lot of new members who weren't here in 2015, didn't have a chance to vote on it, and are looking at it for the first time. And what we've seen just in the last week with public comments by about 18 House Democrats is they're deeply troubled by what they are learning about this deal, and are unlikely to support it if it comes to a vote.
Well, speaking largely more broadly about Iran, what is the Joe Biden, and I guess before that when Joe Biden was Vice President under Barack Obama, what is the view of the Biden administration and his predecessors of Iran? And what sort of relationship are they trying to develop here with Iran? You say they're trying to reform Iran. I mean, what's their ultimate sort of game plan here?
I think, as I said, there used to be a notion that there were moderate regime elements, and that the moderate regime, the key player in that was the foreign minister, Zarif. But since the original deal, the Iranians have taken a hard-line turn, and Zarif and the group he was associated with are out, and Raisi and a much more hardline cohort of bureaucrats are running the show now. And it's much more implausible to claim that the regime is going to perform in a positive direction. And frankly, you hear a lot less of those kinds of claims this time from the Biden administration and allied groups. They don't really claim the regime is likely to change. All they say in trying to sell the deal is we have to curb their pursuit of the bomb somehow, even if it's only for a short time and even if it's in a kind of a slipshod way. We need some kind of a deal. But any hope of changing the regime, that seems to be out of the conversation at this point.
Yeah, I mean, these individuals, I mean, Javad Zarif, who is the foreign minister of Iran, and now you have this new president in Iran, Ibrahim Raisi, who's under the actual authority of Iran as the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei. So, you know, all this talk about, like, a president or elections in Iran is really kind of beside the point, because it is indeed a theocracy headed by the supreme leader now, Ali Khamenei. You know, what hope is there for changing this theocratic Islamic Republic, this jihadist state? I mean, its constitution speaks about a global mission to spread jihad and to spread Islam around the world. So why would anyone think you can reform this country or this regime?
I mean, if there's any hope, it has to come from anti-regime grassroots activities. And we've seen demonstrations, protests from various sectors within the country, and we know that the regime is unpopular. But for now, I think any notion of the regime reforming from a kind of an internal dynamic is unlikely in the extreme.
Well, yeah, that brings up the regime has indeed become increasingly unpopular throughout its life across these past four decades or so. But people have often talked about that President Donald Trump's campaign of maximum pressure of sanctions on Iran was actually threatening the survival of the regime. Is that possible to bring about then a kind of a collapse of the regime, a regime change by such pressure on Iran? Why aren't we doing that?
Well, we should be. Maximum pressure is the policy that seems to be pushing the regime into a corner, and they've been given relief from that pressure. And the position of Republicans in Congress and my organization is that maximum pressure should continue to be the policy. And I guess what's interesting right now is that the talk seemed to have hit some kind of an impasse. They were said to be hours away from a deal in early March, and yet nothing has happened. We know that the Biden administration is frankly desperate for a deal almost at any cost, but dealing with the Iranians in these strange negotiations where the Iranians won't sit at the same table as our negotiators, and the Russians are in the role of intermediary, shuttling back and forth. They just can't seem to close the deal, and it could create a situation. Yeah, I still think it's likelier than not that they get to a deal because the Biden administration is so motivated to get one that they'll give up almost anything and eventually make an offer the Iranians can't refuse. But we could find ourselves in a situation where the Biden administration has to devise a new policy, and I'm sure they've laid no groundwork for this because they've been counting on the revival of this deal. The most of the sanctions the Trump administration imposed are still in effect, but the Biden administration's part is not in enforcement, and so. If these talks do break down without an agreement, they're going to be put in the position of having to apply a policy that they're not enthusiastic about. But maximum pressure, we think, is still the only way to go.
Yeah, people have talked about the sanctions and relief that would occur in such a deal. It would involve perhaps immediately some $90 billion worth of sanctions and relief of, like, unfreezing of accounts and so forth in the United States, and then annually long-term, like, about $50 to $55 billion of relief in the sense of engaging in oil trade with Iran, which is currently under sanctions. So this is, you know, a significant economic input into the Iranian economy. You talk about the desperation to get a new deal. One of the things people talk about is that under the deal, the United States is actually offering to delist Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps from the American listing as a foreign terrorist organization, an FTO. I'll talk a little bit about the dangers of that, of delisting the IRGC and other Iranian individuals and groups from this foreign terrorist organization listing.
Well, of course, the IRGC and its Good Sports unit are the command center for all of the terrorist operations that the Iranian regime supervises and assists. And to lift the sanctions on the IRGC and on the individuals who have been specifically sanctioned would free them up to operate with much more ease to travel around the world and plan terrorist attacks. It would be a huge boon. One thing we've seen the administration try to claim is, well, there'll still be other sanctions even if we delist them from the foreign terrorist organization list. And that just fails the logic test, because if taking them off that list wasn't meaningful, thing, the Iranians wouldn't be making such a hard stand in the negotiations to secure it. I think we had earlier we had reports that the decision to delist had already been made. More recent reports suggest that it's not necessarily cut and dried. And I think part of what's making it difficult for the administration to give in to that demand is the feedback from Congress, and including from Democrats in Congress, saying you just can't do this. And just yesterday, General Milley from the Joint Chiefs of Staff said, in his opinion, they are still a terrorist organization and they should not be taken off this list. So the administration is struggling to present a united front with its own members and allies, and I think that's turned into maybe the thing that could actually take this deal off track, despite the determination and desperation to get it done.
I mean, if we talk about this IRGC, it has also its particularly its expeditionary foot force that foments revolution and instability abroad. I mean, we deal with Hezbollah in Lebanon and other terrorist groups. Of course, we should remember that Donald Trump ordered a drone strike to kill its leader, Qassem Soleimani, at the beginning of 2019, if I recall correctly. Because the Quds Force had been involved in attacks on American forces in Iraq and the Middle East. So, it's really just kind of bizarre that anyone would say, let's delist this organization as a foreign terrorist organization. As you indicate, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Miley, say no, it should not be delisted. So I really don't see how anyone would justify it.
Right. I think they've been trying to come up with some clever way to package it, to portray it as less than what it is. But the Iranians are dug in on this, and it's a very important point, and Congress is going to make that a particular area of focus if the deal does come down.
Well, and this similar, along the similar issue, the Biden administration has already delisted as foreign terrorist organizations various Houthi groups in Yemen. How has that gone so far, that delisting has been taken away? These Houthis that have been, for example, launching attacks against Saudi Arabia, missile attacks.
Right, and more recently, even the UAE, it's already become an additional point of friction with Congress. There's a lot of sentiment in Congress manifested in support for legislation to put the Houthis back on the foreign terrorist organization list, and an expression of concerns on a more ad hoc basis that the policy rationale for delisting the Houthis was that a humanitarian rationale primarily. But the humanitarian entities that are trying to bring relief to the suffering populations in Yemen are still being impeded by the Houthis. Failed on its own terms, and now the Houthis are escalating attacks on our allies in the Gulf, and it's become another instance where irresolution on part of the administration and upholding our standards of fighting terrorism has left us looking weaker and left us more alienated from our allies.
Well, looking at these negotiations that are taking place in Vienna between the Americans and Iranians, as you say, that the Iranians won't even enter the same room with the American diplomats, and so you have the shuttle of diplomacy with the Russian ambassador, Mikhail Leonov, if I'm saying his name right. Our lead negotiator in Vienna, U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley.
And he's been in and out of government, and during his time out of government, he's been the principal of a group called the International Crisis Institute, I believe, some kind of organization that purports to mediate international conflict. But his policy stances have always been extremely sympathetic to our adversaries in the Middle East. He was one who critiqued the Clinton approach to peacemaking between the Israelis and the Palestinians by saying it was the Clinton approach, which was an approach that failed because of Palestinian rejectionism. Malley was one who said, no, the problem was that the Clinton deal was too didn't deliver enough for the Palestinians. The Palestinians were justified in walking away from the table and killing that Clinton effort to make a permanent peace there. His organization has maintained links to Hamas and other terrorist groups in the Middle East. And so, it's a classic illustration of the maxim that personnel is policy. When the Biden administration picked Malley to run these Iran talks, they were signaling their determination to get a deal at any cost. And there have been some notable resignations in the past couple of months from the negotiating team. People like Richard Nephew and others who had been involved in negotiating the 2015 deal, but thought that Malley was giving away the store in these talks and they couldn't be a part of it anymore. So Malley is definitely a extremist operating with the authority of the U.S. government and trying to make a deal on a nuclear program. It's very alarming.
Yeah, Robert Malley used to head the International Crisis Group and had been part of President Barack Obama's campaign team during the 2008 election campaign. And actually, I believe had to leave the campaign when it found out that he had met with Hamas officials. So that just became an embarrassment for the Obama campaign, and they had to get rid of him. So, yeah, this is really an extreme person here, really, really pro-Iran. Well, if we talk about such extremism and these people like Richard Nephew are resigning from the negotiation team in Vienna, is the United States just inviting more terrorism and more Iranian provocations? And we've heard recently that the United States knows about a planned assassination attempt on former National Security Advisor John Bolton here in the United States. He even knows the individuals in the United States that were planning to do this, but has not arrested them. So are we just, appeasing Iran and backing off here and allowing attacks on our forces throughout the Middle East?
Well, it's hard to see it any other way. The threats that have been learned about for Bolton, as well as former special Iran negotiating envoy during the Trump administration, Brian Hook, and former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and when they I think one of the space-saving efforts that they wanted to try and use to make the make the deal on delisting the IRGC as a foreign terrorist organization was that the Iranians would somehow make a promise that they would stop fomenting terrorism in the region, which is ludicrous. A promise from the Iranians is not worth the paper it's written on, and the Iranians wouldn't even give it. So we've seen that the Iranians, even while they're supposed to be pursuing these negotiations with us, have maintained their terrorist orientation, have stepped up their terrorist planning, and now we find out that they won't even agree to stop if they get the deal. So it's another aspect of how terrible this deal is, and how it's almost unthinkable that the Biden administration could bring a deal this bad to the American people and to the Congress, but yet they seem desperate for a win on any terms, and so they seem hell bent on proceeding.
You have to have this recent report that there are individuals perhaps with Iranian passports who have engaged in the deception of presenting themselves as FBI agents to Secret Service agents protecting the president. So this regime is just not ending, apparently, in any of its nefarious activities. And some of the people that are going to be individuals that are going to be freed from sanctions relief under this deal include individuals who were responsible, for example, like the 1994 attack on the Jewish community center in Buenos Aires, Argentina. We have a long, bloody record here, or even for that matter, individuals responsible for the 1983 bombing of the American Marine Barracks in Beirut, Lebanon. So there's a long track record of terrorism here and attacks on America. And it's just unbelievable that no one would ever expect the grant to stop it.
Yeah, a lot of what we learned about the plan to lift terrorism sanctions comes from reporting by a former State Department official in the Trump administration named Gabriel Mirona, and one particularly notable recent article he wrote for Tablet Magazine in which he detailed his track record of some of the individuals who are going to be removed from terrorism sanctions, and particular things aside, people who were involved in planning the 1984 Marine Barracks bombing, who were involved in the 1994 terrorist attack on the Jewish Community Center in Buenos Aires, Argentina, a real rogues gallery. And from the standpoint of the Iranians, it's easy to understand why they would be interested in getting terrorism sanctions relief for some of their terrorist all-stars. The thing that's just very, very difficult to comprehend is what would lead representatives of our government to go along with delisting such individuals.
Well, now, one particularly interesting facet, as you've indicated before here, is that, you know, Russia is acting as sort of a middleman in these negotiations on doing this kind of rooms and manner with their ambassador. And now you say that under the deal, Iran would send to Russia its highly enriched uranium or most of that for storage there. How does this negotiations and any such deals with the Islamic Republic of Iran affect Russia and its interests?
We have indications that it could be a real windfall for the Russians at a time when we're trying to starve the regime of resources. The deal that is emerging would put them in a critical role of building nuclear infrastructure, nuclear power plants for the Iranians, with the rationale that it would give them peaceful nuclear power, and that therefore they wouldn't, because that's always been the pretense of that they've used to explain why they're pursuing all this nuclear technology. Well, we want nuclear power for peaceful purposes. So the deal says, well, we'll facilitate that pursuit by having the Iranians build them a nuclear power plant. And, of course, that will bring a windfall for the Russians. So it is, as you say, an avenue for the Russians to get out from the sanctions that we've been putting on them based on their horrible activities in Ukraine. And it's something that the administration is just brazening out when they've been challenged on it. They say, well, Russia doesn't want Iran to get a nuclear weapon either. That's not even clear necessarily, but it's just terrible policy when we're trying to deter these Russians to give them new benefits, and yet that's what the administration seems hell-bent on doing.
Yeah, I mean, Russia previously has been involved in Iran's nuclear program. I believe the Bushehr nuclear reactor in Iran was built with Russian help. And so Russia has been, a key conduit of technology to Iran. Now with this new deal, if Iran could then release from sanctions, become another key trading partner for Russia. That's just another important market, another important way for Russia to leave sanctions. And I would agree with you. I don't understand why Russia would necessarily be against an Iranian nuclear bomb. I mean, there's no real conflict between Iran and Russia, and Russia would have clearly a superiority of Iran to deal with any threat from Iran militarily, and would not have any objections to Iran, in turn turning its military threats against the United States and its allies to hinder them, to develop like maybe a two-front war with the United States and Iran on one side and Iran and Russia on the other hand. So, this seems like a really ridiculous policy here.
And the other instance where we see the administration continuing to want to maintain cordial diplomatic working relations with the Russians is the global warming portfolio that John Kerry is supposedly overseeing. And Kerry said, well, global warming is too important to let a thing like the Ukraine atrocities derail our cooperation with the Russians. So in both instances, you have a kind of a grand ideological construct in the mind of the key administration officials, and it's just completely at odds with the reality of the policy challenge we face trying to make things less dire on the Ukraine front.
Yeah, there again. We've all got to worry about climate change, right? I mean, that's an ongoing cry that you always hear from people on the political left that, fighting in Syria during the Arab Spring is actually a result of climate change or whatever, and that's the key challenge facing humanity. So here we have, one nuclear power, Russia invading Ukraine. We've got a conflict there, and then we've got perhaps another, significant potential for another nuclear power to develop in Iran. It seemed to me that, nuclear weapons and military aggression are far more serious than all these various theories about climate change that we've been hearing about since, the late 1980s, for the past 30 years, and time and time again, they never really sort of pan out as the way they're being predicted, the ice sheets are going to disappear, or the polar bears are all going to die out. So that seems like a real misplacement of priorities there.
And it's interesting. Yesterday, the UN Human Rights Council actually expelled the Russians, which is the first time I can recall the UN Human Rights Council actually treating human rights violators as persona non grata, but Russia still maintains their spot on the Security Council and their all important veto. And as long as that's the case, it just gives the lie to the notion that we're really doing everything we can to isolate them. And frankly, calls into question the whole notion that the UN is a mechanism that can solve important problems. As long as the Russians are in that key role, it looks like it's more of a mechanism for preserving our most pressing problems.
Well, I guess, and I guess as an aside, you know, Rand's been on the Human Rights Council. Are they currently on the Human Rights Council right now?
I don't think so, no. But I believe Syria is, which is just abominable, given their human rights track record.
Yeah, Syria's just
and Venezuela. Cuba.
Right.
It's a rogue's gallery of human rights violators. You know, kicking the Russians off was the right thing to do, but it doesn't clean up the mess that the Human Rights Council is.
Yeah, I mean, the Human Rights Council has always been a joke, as you say, this rogue's gallery. Thinking of Russia, now that we saw Russia, what about thinking of other dangerous countries in the world? And, of course, we've got a rising China that we've got to worry about even more so, perhaps, than Russia. Does China have any involvement on this deal with Iran? Is there any angle there?
They maybe have been less in the forefront. Not in a role comparable to the Russians, who are actually in a kind of key intermediary role between us and the Iranians. What it seems like they do, though, is give more ballast to the Iranians, because they are broadly sympathetic to the Iranian aims, and they're at the table. The P5 plus one always was a suspect construct, because it included not just our European allies, but the Russians and the Chinese, it was always a diplomatic conceit. Well, the Russians and the Chinese also don't think Iran should get a nuclear weapon, but that was always suspect, and it was always somewhat called into question by the fact that the Russians and Chinese were doing so much business with the Iranians, and including helping them with their nuclear pursuits.
Yeah, I mean, again, there, you know, China has accepted, apparently without any particular qualms, you know, the development of a North Korean nuclear capability. So I don't understand why China would have any particular interest in stopping Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. So, yeah, that is, you know, why were the Chinese included ever in negotiations over a nuclear weapon Iran? Is it just because they're an important trading partner for Iran?
It was based on the notion that they could help deliver the Iranians for a deal, I guess to that extent, from the point of view of the Obama administration, it was a success because they did sign in the end. But it's very, very difficult to understand it from the standpoint of U.S. national interest.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're talking about here this deal just being so bad and for the United States and the free world in general. How are, for example, the Arab states in the region reacting to this deal? I mean, we had in Trump this initiative of the Abraham Accords. We've got a growing together of relations between various Arab states, like United Arab Emirates and Bahrain and Morocco and even Saudi Arabia is perhaps on the verge of taking up diplomatic relations with Israel. How is this deal affecting those Arab states?
Well, we have every indication that they're livid. Last month, there was an effort by Biden to reach his counterparts, the heads of state in Saudi Arabia and the UAE. And they wouldn't take this call. And it was widely understood as a expression of their frustration over the direction of the Iran nuclear talks. The president presumably wanted to talk to them about getting more energy, more oil flowing from those Arab countries to deal with the supply shocks that are related to our response to trying to cut off the Russians, but we weren't able to make that connection and argue for that cooperation because the Gulf regimes are feel like at a time when the administration is asking them for something that is a big ask, you know, essentially undercutting their OPEC agreement for our benefit. What are we offering them? Well, we're offering them the same old Iran deal that they despise. So there is a cost, and it's one that the administration doesn't seem to have any good ideas about how to obviate that dynamic, and it's undercutting our Ukraine policy. Another instance of the desperation for an Iran deal carrying costs that our country is paying.
Well, and then looking at how is Israel reacting to this deal? What's their response? Are they having now, and will they have in the future?
Well, Israel's government, of course, is a different government than. Different. It's a coalition government that includes very left-wing parties as well as right-wing parties. And, of course, the Prime Minister Bennett comes from a right-wing party. And they've had to proceed they felt compelled to proceed with more caution. And they've still made it clear, though, that they're against the emerging deal, that they consider a bad deal worse than no deal. And Israeli public opinion is behind the government on that. It's one of the consensus issues, whether it's the old government or the new government. The Israeli people do not support a nuclear deal with Iran in terms of the Biden administration pursuing it. So it puts another strain on that relationship for sure.
So what would be the possibilities? You know, the Israelis have emphasized that they reserve their freedom of action to respond to any such Iranian nuclear threat. And so they very well, there's always been the possibility that they would strike against Iran or maybe engage in future sabotage and so forth against the Iranian nuclear program. What possibilities would Israel have there?
I think it's something that they have to have as part of their strategic playbook, because it may be that it's the only way to prevent Iran from being able to hold a nuclear sword of Damocles over their head. But I think that from everything I begin to understand, that it's not going to be easy to pull off a mission like that, because the Iranians have had time to broaden and conceal. They famously built one of their major nuclear facilities on the inside of a mountain, and so more and more that nuclear infrastructure is in hardened and protected places, and it would be tough, I think, for the Israelis to block the Iranians on their own. But it's something they still might have to consider.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, this would be a much more long-range mission, say, for any airstrikes, much larger set of targets, broader set of targets than, say, a past Israeli strikes in 1981 on the Iranian nuclear Iraqi nuclear program, and then later 2007 on the Syrian nuclear program, where Israel was able to just go in and strike one single reactor and much closer range. I mean, even Iraq was closer to Israel. So this is really sort of the limit of the extent of what Israel could do here. Well, looking abroad, you know, you mentioned that European countries have been involved in these negotiations in the past. How are the Europeans dealing with Iran and in any possible renewed Iran nuclear deal?
That's one aspect of this that seems pretty similar to 2015, in that the Europeans are letting the Americans take the lead. I think that the The EU, which of course is dominated by Germany, has been broadly supportive of trying to get into the deal. I guess if you are hoping that the Europeans would provide a kind of a alternative locus of influence that might counteract the Biden administration's desperation, it's probably not going to happen, just like it didn't happen with the previous deal in 2015.
Well, then, I guess closing out here, given all these dangers from this deal, what possibilities do people in the legislature have to oppose this deal or to put up roadblocks? On what sort of political price might the Biden administration pay for engaging in such deal? I mean, you're working there as with Congressional Affairs at the Republican Jewish Coalition. I mean, what sort of things might you and others do on Capitol Hill and in the political field more generally?
Well, I think one of the most important things is getting that vote, getting everybody on the record. This is not something that should be looked at principally through a political lens, but it's a situation where the political system is a mechanism for accountability for members who decide, and we're talking about Democrats here, no Republicans supported the deal in 2016. It's quite unlikely that any would do it this time. So there needs to be a vote. Working to achieve that vote has to be one of the highest priorities right now. There will be a bill to restore terrorism sanctions if those terrorism sanctions are lifted. Organizing to support of those bills will be an important rallying point. But those bills won't get to the floor if Democrats are in Congress, but we'll come back to our policy and making sure that
hello, Noah?
Can you hear me?
You're fading out. Oh, no. Yeah, you were talking about, so getting people to vote on this issue, of course, getting people on the record concerning this agreement, and then you can hold them accountable at the ballot box is perhaps the only means of really addressing this issue.
Yeah, but if Republicans are back in control of Congress in 2023, there's going to be a lot of oversight, and the administration is going to have to answer the questions they don't want to answer about this framework and about how they're helping the Iranians through this deal.
Mm-hmm. But I guess ultimately that the main change could only really come through this becoming a presidential election issue and Biden losing the election in 2024 and getting a new president.
Yeah, but that's why a lot of the messaging from Republicans has been towards the business community that might look at a revived deal as an opportunity to go back into business with the Iranians and telling them, don't count on this deal being in place. Don't, next time a Republican administration comes in, the deal's going to be canceled just like the first deal was when Obama was elected by Trump. That vigorous advocacy and outreach to the business community could be effective in limiting the amount of the size of the windfall that the Iranian regime would get from a deal.
Yeah, okay, so that's a real disaster, but I guess we'll just have to wait for a result at the ballot box where we get new leadership, Republican leadership that will get out of this deal. Well, for our listeners out there, you've been listening to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Herrick, and we've been talking with Noah Silverman, the Congressional Affairs Director for the Republican Jewish Coalition, about President Biden's new Iran nuclear deal that is perhaps on the verge of being completed, a real disaster. Well, Noah, thank you for joining the show.
Thanks, Andrew. Great to be with you.
All right, and for our listeners out there, tune in next week for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.